Penguin Random House Audio presents Profiles in Mental Health Courage by Patrick J. Kennedy and Stephen Freed. Read for you by Johnny Heller, with an introduction read by Patrick J. Kennedy.
Prologue. In 1956, my uncle John F. Kennedy, then a U.S. senator, wrote a book that is probably more famous for its great title than its contents. It was called Profiles in Courage, and it was about eight U.S. senators who JFK felt had made particularly courageous contributions to American history. For a while now, I've been thinking about what courage means to me. While growing up with my father, Ted Kennedy, in the United States Senate, and then serving in the House of Representatives myself for many years, I saw quite a bit of bravery in politics. But the truth is, the most courageous people I know qualify not for what they do in public, but for what they're able to endure and rise above in private. This is especially true of people who struggle every day with mental illness or addiction or both, or who help loved ones or family members in their struggles. The details and daily dramas of these struggles usually remain private, hidden. And even when people discuss them publicly, it's often in a brief or very cautious way, enough to admit to having a diagnosis or a problem or issues in order to support advocacy, but rarely enough to inform a public that wants and needs to understand what living with these illnesses is like every day. In 2015, I decided to share an in-depth narrative of my struggles with substance use disorders and mood disorders, along with the politics and discrimination that make these conditions harder to treat and live with than necessary. This was not without risks. Several people extremely close to me warned that if I published the resulting book, A Common Struggle, my relationship with them would never be the same. Sadly, some of them did distance themselves from me, and I ache over those damaged or lost relationships. But for every person who all but closed me off from their life for being open, I met so many who did just the opposite. They led me to believe that sharing my truth had helped set them free with their own, or, at the very least, that my complicated medical history had served to show people in their lives, siblings, spouses, bosses, that what they were going through was not so unique and, in fact, was shockingly common for people with these illnesses. We often quote the statistic that at any given time, at least a quarter of all Americans struggle with mental illness, substance use disorders, or both. And while these are still sometimes viewed as two separate illnesses because two distinct worlds developed to address them, I can tell you, as someone who has them both, that they are best understood and treated together as one complex continuum of diseases of the brain and the mind. Unfortunately, the percentage of people affected by these illnesses is likely quite a bit higher than 25%. And the percentage of those who don't feel comfortable and supported enough to be open about their experiences is much, much higher, as is the percentage of those who cannot access or afford evidence-based care and support. Each time a new statistic is released regarding the state of mental illness diagnoses, addictions to drug or alcohol, overdoses, suicide attempts, and completed suicides, it is followed by a call for a new appreciation of these illnesses, a paradigm shift. But part of this paradigm we need to shift is the idea that these are new problems. If there is anything truly new about them, it is how much incrementally worse they have gotten because we have not done enough as a society to address them. Nor have we made sure that the treatments we already have, which aren't perfect but still can save lives, get delivered to most of the people who need them. Those treatments, which all work, but have been proven to work best together, are medical therapies, talk therapies, and healing relationships. Everything from recovery and support groups to faith groups. Even those getting some form of treatment might not be getting the most evidence-based or complete treatment, And there is often quite a difference between what is approved or legal and what is ideal. This is an age-old problem. You only need to look at the historic figures JFK wrote about in Profiles in Courage to see it. At least half of them, going back to the earliest days of post-revolutionary America, were known to have struggled with mental illness or addiction, or had the struggle for mental wellness profoundly affect their families. John Quincy Adams, whose story first inspired JFK and his co-author Ted Sorensen to write Profiles in Courage, was 9 years old when his father signed the Declaration of Independence, 29 when his father became president, 35 when he himself became a U.S. senator. John Quincy lost both of his younger brothers to alcoholism, beginning with Charles at age 30. His father also suffered from depression, especially after the trauma of losing Charles and losing the presidential election to his friend Thomas Jefferson, all during the same week in 1800. John Quincy's oldest son, George Washington Adams, suffered from depression and took his own life at the age of 28, just 2 months after his father's presidency ended in 1829. Not long after learning of his son's death, John Quincy vowed to use his remaining days for good works, tributary to the well-being of others, and soon became the first ex-president to rejoin the government as a congressman. But he continued to experience tragedy from mental illness. In 1832, his remaining brother, Thomas, died of complications of alcoholism at the age of 59. And 2 years after that, his own son, John, died from the same thing at the age of 31. Among the other seven JFK profiled, Massachusetts lawyer and politician Daniel Webster suffered from alcoholism and died from cirrhosis of the liver in 1852. Sam Houston, a key figure in Texas independence, and the state's first president before becoming a senator, had a well-known battle with alcoholism and either depression or bipolar disorder. He may qualify as the nation's first case of political mental health stigma. His nickname amongst the Cherokee, with whom he had been close since childhood, was Utsete Arditaski, or Big Drunk, and his drinking was an open, caustic issue in his public life. His third wife, who he married when she was 21 and he was 47, made it her mission to help him remain sober, but his political adversaries continue to publicly shame him. Lucius Lamar, the U.S. Senator from Mississippi, was only 9 years old when his namesake father, a prominent Georgia judge, took his own life just days before his 37th birthday in 1834. He reportedly entered his house, wrote a short farewell note to his family, walked into the garden, and shot himself in the head with his pistol. And these are just the ones we know about and can begin to document. None of this should be surprising, but somehow it still is. Our nation is experiencing perhaps its most pronounced crisis of mental illness and substance use disorders in history. Already high depression and anxiety rates rose another 25% worldwide after the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic. Yet too many of us still don't understand what the experience of having or treating these diseases is like. In our society, you don't have to have cancer or heart disease or diabetes to understand the basic dynamics and challenges of living with these illnesses. Their treatment has become part of our culture, openly discussed and encouraged. But when it comes to diseases that affect the brain, cognition, mood, thought, impulsivity, and self-destructiveness, we are surprised again and again, or ignorant in a way that isn't just unsupportive, but can be downright dangerous. At the height of COVID, when Simone Biles announced she would not compete in the Summer Olympics to preserve her mental health, I was watching the public reaction with fascination and sadness.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?